Like John Roberts, Samuel Alito had been nominated for a federal appeals court judgeship during the first Bush administration. Unlike Roberts, Alito had been confirmed, taking his seat on the Third Circuit in 1990. The backgrounds of the two men were similar. Alito came from more modest circumstances. His father was a civil servant in New Jersey state government. But young Sam, like the future Chief Justice, had an Ivy League education, with Princeton followed by Yale Law. Then, like Roberts, Alito had been a star among the cadre of young conservative lawyers who accompanied Ronald Reagan to Washington. Alito spent 4 years in the Solicitor General's office, two more with the Office of Legal Counsel, then, in 1987, became the U.S. Attorney in his home state of New Jersey. Alito had just turned 40 in 1990 when he received his lifetime appointment to the federal bench. A year later, Alito had a chance to help his fellow judicial conservatives usher Roe v. Wade to its demise. The new judge participated in the Apockel-Casey lawsuit as part of the three-judge panel that reviewed the Pennsylvania law. The Third Circuit panel upheld the law's restrictions on abortion, such as its new rules on parental consent and waiting periods, almost in their entirety. But two of the three judges thought one provision about spousal notification went too far, noting that the number of different situations in which women may reasonably fear dire consequences from notifying their husbands is potentially limitless. The majority ruled that part of the law violated women's rights. Alito disagreed. He wrote his own opinion, saying that he would have improved the Pennsylvania law in full and thus offered states a roadmap to restricting abortions as much as possible without outlawing the practice altogether. Since Pennsylvania wanted to limit the number of abortions, Alito said the requirement that wives notify their husbands of their plans was a reasonable means to that objective. Alito wrote in the same bland way that he spoke, and he observed, "The Pennsylvania legislature could have rationally believed that some married women are initially inclined to obtain an abortion without their husband's knowledge because of perceived problems such as economic constraints, future plans, or the husband's previously expressed opposition that may be obviated by discussion prior to the abortion." The following year, the troika of O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter saved Roe in their joint opinion in the case. In drafting the portion of the Casey opinion striking down spousal notification, O'Connor had excoriated Alito's logic, approach, and conclusions. Famously, O'Connor had called Alito's view repugnant to our present understanding of marriage and of the nature of the rights secured by the Constitution. Women do not lose their constitutionally protected liberty when they marry. Now, that very judge was getting a promotion to O'Connor's own seat, and largely because Alito had proved his conservative bona fides in that very case. As one White House lawyer said of the new nominee, he was on the bench for 15 years, and he never got a case wrong. On the morning that O'Connor resigned, Stephen Breyer heard the news on National Public Radio. The two had become so close that it hurt Breyer's feelings a little that she gave him no advance notice. Typically, O'Connor just attributed her secrecy to common sense. She didn't want to place any of her colleagues in an awkward position if they were asked about her plans. But her alliance with Breyer had only grown stronger over time. In some cases, it was hard to tell which one of them represented the court's swing vote. Few justices took to the work of the Supreme Court with greater ease or enthusiasm than Stephen Breyer. His intelligence had never been in doubt, but when Clinton appointed him in 1994, Breyer had little experience in the grist of Supreme Court work, constitutional law. He was a problem solver, a technocrat, an antitrust and administrative law expert, the author of the Federal Sentencing Guidelines. He was not someone who had given much thought to the majestic generalities of the Constitution. But in 2005, he did something that no justice had attempted in several generations, to write his own manifesto on the meaning of the Constitution. Characteristically, Breyer's book, Active Liberty, was hardly an airy philosophical treatise, but a practical book by a practical man. "Our constitutional history," he wrote, "has been a quest for workable government, workable democratic government protective of individual personal liberty." No word better suited Breyer's approach than workable. Visitors to Breyer's chambers at the court might assume that the rows of venerable leather-bound books in the shelves behind his desk came from his wife's aristocratic family in Great Britain. Their home in Cambridge is full of heirlooms from the stately home of the first Viscount Blakenham. But the books were collected by Breyer's late uncle, Leo Roberts, an eccentric philosopher and freelance academic who haunted used book sales. Young Stephen and his uncle would sometimes rise at dawn to get first crack at the sales, where they rarely paid more than a dollar a book. And there were ultimately thousands of books, which Breyer, with just the exceptions in his chambers, donated to the University of Massachusetts in Boston after Roberts died. Breyer's demeanor, as well as his jurisprudence, reflected both his patrician in-laws and his own Jewish parents. He sometimes lapsed into what sounded like an English accent, and one of his daughters became, of all things, an Episcopal priest. But Breyer's reluctance to stir up religious animosity was strictly urban Paul in origin. From his parents and their experience in San Francisco politics, he learned of the dangers of religious conflict, even in the United States, and he saw the Constitution as a vehicle to keep ecumenical passions in check. A natural conciliator, Breyer liked nothing less than picking unnecessary fights. And that spirit, in 2005, gave Breyer something close to control of the court. Of all the justices, he cast the fewest dissenting votes that year, 10, just behind O'Connor's 11. He brokered an extraordinary compromise in a series of complex cases reviewing the federal sentencing guidelines that he, as an appeals court judge, had played a major role in creating. After years of hotly contested cases on the subject, the result was that the guidelines would be advisory rather than mandatory, which is what Breyer had sought all along. He controlled the outcome of two cases about public display of the Ten Commandments, voted with Kennedy on the juvenile death penalty, and even joined an unusual majority in the most enjoyable case of the year. In May, the court ruled 5-4, that states could not permit in-state wineries to ship to consumers while prohibiting out-of-state producers from doing the same thing. The pro-wine majority consisted of Kennedy, the author of the opinion, Scalia, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, who all happened to be the leading wine aficionados on the court. Breyer later called the group the Rosy-Cheeked Caucus. This long run of success was why Breyer despaired at the other big case that came down at the end of the same term. In 1998, Pfizer had announced plans to build a research facility in New London, Connecticut. The city intended to spruce up the surrounding neighborhood. As part of the development, New London used its power of eminent domain to take the homes of several residents and turn them over to private developers for a shopping center or perhaps a parking lot. Suzette Kilo and several of her neighbors sued, claiming that the city was violating the Fifth Amendment, which says that private property shall not be taken for public use without just compensation. A city could take land for a highway, a school, or a hospital, the plaintiffs claimed, but the transfer of private property from one private entity to another did not amount to a public use. When Kilo versus the City of New London was argued back in February 2005, the case drew relatively little attention. Even to the justices, the matter seemed to be a fairly esoteric dispute over a familiar part of the Constitution. The court had found that government could use eminent domain powers to transfer land to private entities before, to railroads, for example, and the question here was simply whether an urban redevelopment plan qualified as a public use. It hardly seemed the stuff of high drama. And at the end of the term, Stevens wrote a straightforward opinion for a 5-justice majority, including Kennedy, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, approving what the city had done. Stevens styled his opinion as an exercise in judicial restraint, as he deferred to the local elected officials about what constituted a public use. Just as we declined to second-guess the city's considered judgments about the efficacy of its development plan, we also declined to second-guess the city's determinations as to what lands it needs to acquire in order to effectuate the project, Stevens wrote. But the justices, especially Stevens, had misjudged the emotional resonance of the subject. By raising the possibility that a city could simply transfer a private home to another private owner, the case tapped into powerful fears of unchecked government. O'Connor understood better than any of her colleagues how the public would see the case and wrote in her dissent, "Under the banner of economic development, all private property is now vulnerable to being taken and transferred to another private owner, so long as it might be upgraded, i.e. given to an owner who will use it in a way that the legislature deems more beneficial to the public." This was one of the few cases where O'Connor and Breyer parted company. In any event, the Kelo decision set off a noisy backlash. Overnight, it was as if the Terri Schiavo chorus had reconvened. Rather than as a victory for judicial restraint, the conservative movement treated Kelo as a triumph of big government. Tom DeLay called it a horrible decision, adding, "This Congress is not going to idly sit by, and let an unaccountable judiciary make these kinds of decisions without taking our responsibility and our duty given to us by the Constitution to be a check on the judiciary." DeLay in the House and John Cornyn in the Senate introduced measures to deny federal funds to any local project that would use eminent domain to force people to sell their property to make way for a profit-making venture. Breyer despaired at the drubbing the court was taking. He took every opportunity to point out that the decision did not order any local government to buy land, but merely permitted the practice under limited circumstances. The complaints should have gone to the initiators of such seizures, not the justices. In truth, the controversy was stoked by conservatives precisely because it took place at the same time as the confirmation fights. The cause united social and economic conservatives against a liberal Supreme Court. As Sean Rushton, the executive director of the Committee for Justice, an organization dedicated to pushing Bush's judicial nominees, said of the Kelo decision, "It's so bad, it's good." When Roberts began his first term, with O'Connor still on the bench, the court enjoyed a docket full of relatively uncontroversial cases. In addition, the new Chief Justice made a point of pushing his colleagues toward narrow decisions that could command unanimous support. In a speech at Georgetown, he made the case for this judicial minimalism, asserting, "The broader the agreement among the justices, the more likely it is a decision on the narrowest possible grounds." For a time, the justices indulged the chief's wishes, and the percentage of unanimous cases ticked upward. In conference, Roberts let discussions linger for longer than Rehnquist had, and the additional conversation encouraged the justices to absorb the views of their colleagues and write opinions accordingly. Roberts' buoyant good nature and the end to the grim vigil over Rehnquist's health immediately made the court a cheerier place. Roberts also proved himself a skillful judicial craftsman. His first important opinion touched on gay rights, academic freedom, and the power of the military, and still produced a unanimous court. The case also revealed the deep cleavages in the legal profession between the liberal faculties of leading law schools and the conservative majorities in Congress. After the fights early in the Clinton administration over gays in the military, most leading law schools banned military recruiters on campus because the armed services refused to hire openly gay people and thus violated the school's non-discrimination policies. Many of the faculty votes for the bans were unanimous, suggesting an extraordinary level of political conformism. Enraged at these snubs to the military, conservatives in Congress responded by passing the Solomon Amendment, which cut off all federal funds to universities that did not allow equal access to recruiters from the armed forces. At many universities, the amendment put tens of millions of dollars in federal medical research money at risk. So law school faculty members sued, arguing that the law violated their rights to free speech under the First Amendment. In an opinion by Roberts, the court unanimously upheld the Solomon Amendment and rejected the claim by the law professors. In short, Roberts said, "He who pays the piper calls the tune." Congress is free to attach reasonable and unambiguous conditions to federal financial assistance that educational institutions are not obligated to accept, he wrote. The case had nothing to do with free speech, he said, arguing that the Solomon Amendment neither limits what law schools may say nor requires them to say anything. As a general matter, the Solomon Amendment regulates conduct, not speech. In this way, Roberts diffused a potentially incendiary controversy. The same was true for Roberts' first encounter with abortion. In 2003, New Hampshire passed a law prohibiting physicians from performing an abortion on a minor without giving one of her parents at least 48 hours' notice. Physicians could dispense with the notification requirement if they could certify that the abortion was necessary to prevent the minor's death. The main issue in the case was whether the state also had to establish an exception to the notice requirement if the minor's health was at risk. For decades, the court had insisted on health exceptions in abortion laws, and for just as long, abortion opponents had argued that such exceptions were so broad that they amounted to no restriction at all. The case concerned a fairly narrow corner of the law, but there is no such thing as an unimportant abortion ruling at the Supreme Court, and the case seemed likely to offer the first clues as to how the Roberts Court would deal with this most fraught topic on its agenda. But Roberts, with the unanimous agreement of his colleagues, managed to avoid a major confrontation. The lower courts had invalidated the entire New Hampshire law when they could have evaluated just the contested portion. The justices thus resolved the case on procedural grounds, sending it back for further review and perhaps some sort of compromise settlement. This kind of opinion, avoiding a hot controversy if at all possible, was a classic O'Connor strategy, and it was fitting that Roberts assigned her the opinion. Ayotte versus Planned Parenthood of Northern New England would be the final majority opinion of Sandra O'Connor's quarter century as a justice, and an apt summary of her extraordinary influence on the court and the nation. "We do not revisit our abortion precedents today," she began, but she did take the time to offer a summary of that law. "We have long upheld state parental involvement statutes like the act before us, and we cast no doubt on those holdings today," she wrote. As for laws regulating abortions themselves, O'Connor said that they were to be tested under the undue burden standard. She went on, "New Hampshire does not dispute, and our precedents hold, that a state does not restrict access to abortions that are necessary in appropriate medical judgment for preservation of the life or health of the mother." The eternal quotation marks came from the Casey decision, which was in turn quoting Roe v. Wade. The dry legal language obscured that this brief opinion amounted to a story of remarkable personal triumph for O'Connor. Like most other Americans, O'Connor believed in parental notification laws. Like most others, she also believed that not all abortions should be banned. And she thought, again like most of her fellow citizens, that abortion restrictions should not risk the life or health of the mother. When she joined the court in 1981, not one other justice believed that abortion laws should be tested under an undue burden standard. But O'Connor had invented the test and over time persuaded a majority of her colleagues to agree with her. She had single-handedly remade the law in the most controversial area of Supreme Court jurisprudence, and she had done it in a way that both reflected and satisfied the wishes of most Americans. No other woman in United States history, and very few men, made such an enormous impact on their country. O'Connor read Ayotte from the bench on January 18, 2006. By that point, though, the longevity of her influence seemed ever more open to question. Samuel Alito joined the court almost 4 months to the day after Roberts, and the two of them struggled to keep up with the sudden onslaught of cert petitions and oral arguments. Their distinct coping mechanisms reflected the modest but real differences between them. Roberts immediately endeared himself to the loyal and long-serving Supreme Court staff by keeping on Rehnquist's secretaries and some of his law clerks. He brought others with him from the D.C. Circuit. In recent years, some of the conservative justices on the court had begun hiring slightly older law clerks who had completed both the customary appellate clerkship and spent some time in the Bush Justice Department. Alito took this practice to an extreme, hiring as his first clerk Adam Cungoli, a 37-year-old senior vice president of Time Warner who had recently completed a 2-year stint as one of John Ashcroft's closest aides. It's easy to overstate the importance of law clerks, but the appointment of Cungoli, who had clerked for Alito a decade earlier on the Third Circuit, suggested a closer-than-usual tie between the new justice and the administration. In any event, The fortuitous absence of blockbuster cases in the first few months of the Roberts Court allowed the justices to become acclimated to their new surroundings. Curiously, the person most affected by the two appointments appeared to be Scalia, who had just turned 70. In public, Scalia had joked about the possibility of becoming Chief Justice, but the recognition that his career had reached a final plateau seems to have encouraged him to shed his inhibitions. For all his theatrics and oral arguments, and the panache of his dissenting opinions, Scalia simply did not love the job as much as his colleagues did. As far back as 1996, he had written to Harry Blackmun, "I am more discouraged this year than I have been at the end of any of my previous 9 terms up here. I am beginning to repeat myself and don't see much use in it anymore." 10 years later, Scalia was still repeating himself, and he was bored. It should have been a glorious time for Scalia, with 2 new like-minded justices joining the court. But as Scalia contemplated his 20th anniversary on the bench, his legacy looked modest. Although his famous dissents often produced admiring chuckles among his readers, they only rarely became law. In 2 decades on a generally conservative court, his number of important majority opinions was almost shockingly small. Asked at a public forum his favorite of his opinions, a common question for the justices in such settings, he came up with an esoteric case interpreting the Confrontation Clause of the 6th Amendment. Nor did Scalia have much influence on his colleagues. Most famously, from the beginning of his tenure, Scalia had actively repelled O'Connor, pushing her towards her moderate swing role. He had a similar effect on Kennedy. Even Thomas had long since passed Scalia, en route to a kind of 19th-century conservatism. And the 2 new justices, though they almost always voted with Scalia in their early days on the bench, seemed to be cutting independent paths. In his confirmation hearing, Roberts issued a nearly Breyer-style denunciation of Scalia's originalism, saying, "I think the framers, when they used broad language like liberty, like due process, like unreasonable with respect to searches and seizures, they were crafting a document that they intended to apply in a meaningful way down the ages." Moreover, Roberts' much-advertised minimalism clashed with Scalia's more sweeping approach to writing opinions. As part of his textualism, Scalia shunned any reference to the legislative history of laws, preferring to interpret only the actual words of a statute rather than the congressional debates leading to a law's passage. But in one of his very first opinions, Alito did cite legislative history, and Scalia, as he always did, dissociated himself from the reference. In Roberts and Alito's first year, there turned out to be only one blockbuster case. Once again, the justices would return to the prisoners of Guantanamo Bay. Few cases had a more unlikely journey to the Supreme Court than Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. The primary instigators of the lawsuit were a small group of military lawyers who, at great risk to their careers, agreed to represent the detainees at Guantanamo. These lawyers, led by Will Gunn of the Air Force and Charles Swift of the Navy, proved to be dogged if overmatched in repeatedly challenging the actions of their superiors in the Department of Defense. For help, they turned to a 33-year-old law professor at Georgetown, Neil Cattell, who had served briefly in the Clinton Justice Department after finishing a clerkship with Breyer. With minimal assistance and vastly more experienced adversaries, Cattell constructed a legal assault on the Bush administration's legal position that changed constitutional history. In 2004, when the justices had first contemplated the case of the prisoners in Cuba, the Bush administration had argued that the case should have been thrown out forthwith, that the detainees were simply outside the reach of the American legal system, with no rights even to bring a case. The justices had rejected this claim in a pair of opinions that included O'Connor's tart reminder that a state of war is not a blank check for the president. In response, the administration had unilaterally set up a system for allowing the detainees to challenge their incarcerations in abbreviated trials known as commissions. It was this system that the military lawyers, later joined by Cattell, were challenging. For their client, Cattell and his colleagues chose perhaps the least threatening prisoner taken from the battlefields of Afghanistan, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, who was accused of being Osama bin Laden's driver but not a terrorist or even a fighter himself. The young professor had one important advantage in the argument on Monday morning, March 28th, the extremism of the claims made by the Bush administration. Kital was making his first argument before the justices. His adversary, Paul Clement, the Solicitor General, was making his 34th. Clement argued that in authorizing a response to the attacks of September 11th, Congress had implicitly suspended the writ of habeas corpus, something that had been done only four previous times in American history. It was a claim that nearly sent Souter flying over the bench. Isn't there a pretty good argument that a suspension of the writ by Congress is just about the most stupendously significant act that the Congress of the United States can take, he asked? And therefore, we ought to be at least a little slow to accept your argument that it can be done from pure inadvertence? Well, Clement replied, if we're only talking about people outside the territory of the United States, now wait a minute, Souter shot back, the writ is the writ. But in a Supreme Court without O'Connor, Hamdan would be a breathless wait to see which way Anthony Kennedy was going to vote. Scalia, Thomas, and Alito were likely allies of the administration. Stevens, Souter, Breyer, and Ginsburg would go the other way. Roberts could not participate because he had already ruled in the case on the Bush side in the D.C. Circuit. The case tapped into Kennedy's deep interest in international law. Indeed, in just a few weeks, Kennedy would be leaving for Salzburg and then, in 2006, for a round-the-world tour, Washington to Hawaii for a speech before the American Bar Association, to Malaysia to meet with the Sultan, who was also a judge, on to Dubai for a conference of 400 judges, and then to the Old Bailey in London, where he would observe a murder trial, and finally back to Washington. The heart of the Bush administration's argument before the court in Hamdan was that the Geneva Conventions, the treaty that is at the core of international law and that the United States had long ago signed, did not apply to the prisoners at Guantanamo. Well, let me put it this way, Kennedy said to Kital. If we were to find that the Geneva Convention or other settled principles of international law were controlling here, why couldn't we just remand to the D.C. Circuit and let it figure it out? That might work, Kital said. Well, suppose we told the D.C. Circuit that the Geneva Convention or some other body of international law controls. Kennedy was tipping his hand. At conference, he joined the four liberals in striking down the Bush plans for Guantanamo. Again. Stevens' opinion for the court, issued on June 29th, the last day of the term, amounted to an even more thorough rebuke to the administration than the court had issued 2 years earlier. The Pentagon could not write procedures for the military commissions unilaterally. Congress had to approve them as well. The Pentagon could not ignore the Geneva Conventions. The procedures had to comport with the treaty. The courts would not sit out the dispute, as Clement had urged, until detainees had actually been convicted and sentenced. The administration would have to start complying with the Constitution right away. Writing in his usual restrained style, Stevens made clear that he and his colleagues regarded the Bush position as something close to lawless. The Geneva Convention is applicable here, he wrote, and requires that Hamdan be tried by a regularly constituted court, affording all the judicial guarantees which are recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. The dissenters replied with rhetoric that reflected the Republican political campaigns of 2002, 2004, and 2006. Thomas said the decision would sorely hamper the president's ability to confront and defeat a new and deadly enemy, and, joined by Scalia and Alito, suggested that it undermined the nation's ability to prevent future attacks. Joined by Kennedy, Souter, and Ginsburg, Breyer issued an unusually pointed and eloquent reply in a concurring opinion in which he quoted the famous words of his departed ally, O'Connor. The court's conclusion ultimately rests upon a single ground. Congress has not issued the executive a blank check. As both sides in Hamdan recognized, the case was crucial, and not just because the detainees in Guantanamo Bay faced the possibility of execution by their American captors. The lawsuit was about defining the meaning of the Constitution in an age of terror, and with a changing Supreme Court. Where, as here, no emergency prevents consultation with Congress, judicial insistence upon that consultation does not weaken our nation's ability to deal with danger, Breyer wrote. To the contrary, that insistence strengthens the nation's ability to determine, through democratic means, how best to do so. The Constitution places its faith in those democratic means. Our court today simply does the same. In speeches, Chief Justice Roberts stood by his call for judicial minimalism. Narrow decisions endorsed by clear majorities, or better yet, unanimous agreement of the justices. But the promises of incremental change masked the truth about the Roberts Court on the only thing that mattered, the substance of its decisions. George W. Bush's second term has been marked by a series of political calamities for the president and his party. On the Iraq War, Hurricane Katrina, Social Security and immigration reform, and the midterm elections, to name a few. But one major and enduring project went according to plan, the transformation of the Supreme Court. Quickly, almost instantly by the usual stately pace of the justices, the court in 2006 and 2007 became a dramatically more conservative institution. Outsiders recognized the change before the justices acknowledged it. The first clear indication came from the lawyers in the court's first major school desegregation case in many years. In Louisville, schools had been segregated by law before Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. And even after the court struck down the doctrine of separate but equal, Kentucky officials, like so many around the nation, avoided complying with Brown and maintained separate schools for black and white students into the 1970s. But when the community finally decided to comply with the law, Louisville faced a familiar problem. Its neighborhoods were so segregated that placing students only in schools close to their homes would scarcely change the racial balance. As a result, the school board eventually came up with a plan in the mid-80s that considered a variety of issues in assigning children to schools. Student choice was a major factor, as was the presence of siblings in a school, but race counted as well. Louisville managed enrollment so that each school had no less than 15% and no more than 50% black students. A group of parents challenged the plan in court, asserting that the school board had no right to use race in school assignments. In a related case, a similar plan in Seattle was attacked as well. At one level, the two school cases looked easy. As lower courts had noted, the plans comported with the rules O'Connor had set down in the Grutter v. Bollinger case just 3 years earlier. Like the University of Michigan Law School, the Louisville and Seattle school boards decided that they wanted to foster diversity in their communities. And like Michigan, the schools included race as one factor among several in selecting students. But the Supreme Court of 2006 and 2007 was not the Supreme Court of 2003, and the lawyers for the Louisville parents put the challenge to the justices in the most direct way. The same month that Alito was confirmed, the parents asked the justices to grant certiorari in their case. To the lawyers in the new case, the question presented was straightforward and chilling for O'Connor's legacy. Should Grutter v. Bollinger be overturned? Certiorari was granted. Like all former justices, of course, O'Connor could only watch what the court would do to the precedent she had laid down. Her retirement had turned out to be nothing like what she expected. O'Connor had left the court to be with her husband, but during the long delay, his illness took a cruel toll on John O'Connor. Alzheimer's disease follows an unpredictable path, and John deteriorated much faster than anyone had expected. By 2007, he no longer knew his wife. He was moved to an assisted living facility in Phoenix near the O'Connor's sons. In a sad irony, Justice O'Connor had not wanted to resign, but did so to take care of John, and then suddenly there was nothing she could do for him. O'Connor responded in a characteristic manner, not with self-pity or despair, but rather with almost frenzied work and activity. In her first fall away from the court, she threw herself into the cause that had obsessed her since the Terri Schiavo case. In 2006, she sponsored, organized, and hosted a conference at Georgetown University Law Center on judicial independence. Many speakers at the conference targeted the Republicans who had been challenging judges on such issues as abortion, criminal sentencing, and the influence of foreign courts throughout the Bush years. O'Connor's self-confidence was intact. At a planning meeting for the Georgetown event, several people wondered if the new Chief Justice might attend. "You just leave John Roberts to me," O'Connor promised, and the new chief dutifully paid homage. At the court, suddenly it was up to Anthony Kennedy. Even more than O'Connor had over the previous decade, Kennedy now controlled the outcome of case after case. During the Rehnquist years, O'Connor and Kennedy had idiosyncratic enough views that it wasn't always clear whose vote would turn out to be dispositive. But the Roberts Court had four outspoken conservatives, Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, and four liberals, at least by contemporary standards, Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Kennedy always was in the middle, and he loved it. Kennedy had long had the most difficult judicial philosophy on the court to describe. It was centered on his perception of the judge and himself as a figure of drama and wisdom, more than any specific ideology. Kennedy believed that, at home and abroad, the rule of law was protected by enlightened individuals as much as by any identifiable approach to the law. In his two decades on the court, Kennedy had come to have a usually predictable, if intellectually incoherent, collection of views. He believed what he believed, but it was hard to say why. This was especially true on abortion. He had been the key figure in the Casey decision of 1992 and the author of the passages affirming the result in Roe v. Wade. The opinion was jointly written with O'Connor and Souter, but only Kennedy's portion was written in his distinctive purple prose. The liberty of the woman is at stake in a sense unique to the human condition and so unique to the law, he wrote. Her suffering is too intimate and personal for the state to insist, without more, upon its own vision of the woman's role, however dominant that vision has been in the course of our history and our culture. The destiny of the woman must be shaped to a large extent on her own conception of her spiritual imperatives and her place in society. 8 years after Casey in 2000, Kennedy had changed his mind, dramatically. In Stenberg v. Carhart, Breyer had painstakingly demonstrated that Nebraska's ban on so-called partial birth abortion had done just what Kennedy said a state could not do. But Kennedy wrote a theatrical dissent, asserting that the political processes of the state are not to be foreclosed from enacting laws to promote the life of the unborn and to ensure respect for all human life and its potential. Adopting the language of the anti-abortion movement, Kennedy called the doctors who performed the procedure abortionists and claimed that medical procedures must be governed by moral principles having their foundation in the intrinsic value of human life, including life of the unborn. Kennedy's hymn to women's autonomy in 1992 turned into a paean to the life of the unborn in 2000. After Bush's election, Congress and the president bet that Kennedy's view, not Breyer's, would ultimately hold sway at the court. Congress passed a federal law that was nearly identical to the Nebraska statute struck down by Breyer's opinion. Like the one from Nebraska, the federal law banned the partial birth procedure, and it did not contain an exception that permitted the procedure to protect the health of the mother. Every appeals court that evaluated the new law found it unconstitutional, relying on Breyer's Stenberg opinion and the absence of a health exception. But it was the new Roberts Court that heard the appeal of those decisions early in the 2006 term. The result gave a hint of what was to come. Alito's replacement of O'Connor flipped the result in the case to a 5-4 ratification of the federal abortion law. Roberts assigned the case to Kennedy, who essentially turned his Stenberg dissent into a majority opinion, the sweetest kind of vindication that a Supreme Court justice can enjoy. The court in the new case, Gonzalez v. Carhart, did not formally overrule Stenberg, but did so effectively. Breyer's opinion and the requirement that abortion prohibitions contain exceptions to protect the health of the mother were now obsolete. As always, Kennedy had to turn the attention to himself. In his view, the ruling was not simply a ratification of an act of Congress, but rather his gift to women as well. "While we find no reliable data to measure the phenomenon," Kennedy wrote, "it seems unexceptionable to conclude some women come to regret their choice to abort the infant life they once created and sustained. Small wonder that Kennedy found no such data, because notwithstanding the claims of the anti-abortion movement, no scientifically respectable support exists for this patronizing notion. Notably, too, foreign law, which had often pushed Kennedy to the left, was generally more restrictive of abortion rights than that of the United States. So on this subject, unlike gay rights or the death penalty, Kennedy mostly received reinforcement from his colleagues abroad. Given Kennedy and Alito's well-known views on abortion, no student of the court could be surprised at the result in the case. Still, the expansiveness of Kennedy's opinion, with its dismissive acknowledgments of the Roe and Casey precedents, left the four liberals on the court shocked, and the year had just started. In his confirmation hearing, Roberts had suggested that the court could increase the number of cases it heard, but the justices' schedule in the fall of 2006 set them on a pace to issue embarrassingly few opinions. Fearing criticism for their languid ways, the justices quickly filled their calendar for the set of arguments that began in January 2007. The year would still yield only 68 decisions, a record low for the court in modern times, but the backloaded schedule made for a hectic spring. Indeed, the decisions came so fast that it took a while even for the justices themselves to recognize what was going on. Ginsburg saw it first. Shy, awkward, isolated from her colleagues in her second-floor chambers, Ginsburg had never been a center of influence at the court. She lacked Stevens' seniority, Breyer's bonhomie, Scalia's bombast, or O'Connor or Kennedy's swing justice status. Ginsburg had a particular aversion to Kennedy's intellectual meanderings. As it happened, two of the justices Ginsburg liked most, Rehnquist and O'Connor, left in quick succession, so she began the term lonelier than usual. But more than the others, Ginsburg was free of illusions about the supposedly apolitical nature of judging and made a clear-eyed assessment of the motives and consequences of her colleagues' actions. What Ginsburg saw was that the conservatives were taking over and moving swiftly to consolidate their gains. The arguments hadn't changed, the personnel had. Over the past few years, O'Connor had moved left so swiftly that she probably passed Breyer in that direction, and Rehnquist had become an institutionalist, committed to the stability of the court more than to ideological change. Roberts and Alito were different, as the spring of 2007 quickly illustrated. As Ginsburg observed Riley in her dissent in the abortion case, the only reason for the result was that the court is differently composed than it was when we last considered a restrictive abortion regulation. As a minor consolation, the abortion case gave Ginsburg the chance to float her own distinctive view of the constitutional basis for abortion rights. Even before she became a judge, Ginsburg had not cared for Blackmun's privacy rationale in Roe v. Wade. Rather, as she wrote in her dissent in Gonzalez v. Carhart, legal challenges to undue restrictions on abortion procedures do not seek to vindicate some generalized notion of privacy. Rather, they center on a woman's autonomy to determine her life's course and thus to enjoy equal citizenship stature. Ginsburg believed abortion rights protected women's equality, not their privacy, and she persuaded all of her fellow dissenters, Stevens, Souter, and Breyer, to sign on with her. But as the spring wore on, these four justices increasingly were speaking only to each other. For years, Ginsburg had prided herself on her restraint in writing dissents, citing O'Connor and Souter as her fellow exemplars of politesse. In speeches and in private, she said that she thought Scalia-style posturing and invective distracted the court from its work. But on April 18th, she read her fiery dissent in the abortion case from the bench, and on May 29th, she denounced her colleagues in Ledbetter versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, a case that seemed almost designed to infuriate her. While still a law school professor, Ginsburg had represented women in equal pay cases under Title VII, which bans discrimination in the workplace. That law requires individuals to file their cases within 180 days of the alleged unlawful employment practice. For years, the court said that if a woman sued within 180 days of her last offending paycheck, she received compensation for the entire period she had suffered from discrimination. But in Ledbetter, the five conservatives ruled that the plaintiffs could be paid for discrimination only within the six-month statute of limitations. The court does not comprehend or is indifferent to the insidious way in which women can be the victims of pay discrimination, she said. As Ginsburg knew better than anyone who had ever served on the court, the majority's ruling ignored the realities of actual litigation. She said that women can't possibly know within 180 days that they are being paid less than men. Ledbetter's initial readiness to give her employer the benefit of the doubt should not preclude her from later seeking redress for the continuing payment to her of a salary depressed because of her sex, Ginsburg continued. She concluded by imploring Congress to amend Title VII to make clear the majority's interpretation was wrong. Her current colleagues, Ginsburg suggested, were beyond help. In his 2 years as chief, Roberts made his public goals clear: decide more cases, achieve more unanimity, write narrower opinions, judicial minimalism. In 2007, Roberts failed on each one. Only 25% of the decisions were unanimous, down from 45% in his first year. About a third of the opinions were unanimous in the Rehnquist years. Even more striking, 33% of the cases in 2006 and 2007 were decided by votes of 5-4, a level of division unprecedented in the court's recent history. So was Roberts' second year a failure? To the contrary. The new chief's stated goals dealt with procedural niceties. The president who nominated him and those who pushed Bush to appoint him cared above all about the substance of the court's decisions, and the changes were dramatic in precisely the way Roberts' sponsors saw it. As the spring of 2007 wore on, the pace of conservative change accelerated. The court invalidated some of the restrictions on political advertising in the McCain-Feingold campaign finance bill, less than 4 years after the court had approved practically the same rules. In a key church-state ruling, the court made it much harder for citizens to challenge government action that endorsed or supported religious activity. In a curious case from Alaska, the court reduced the free speech rights of students by approving the suspension of a high school senior who unfurled a banner that said, "Bong hits for Jesus." All of these cases were 5-4, with Kennedy joining the conservatives. In several of these cases, on abortion, campaign finance, church-state relations, the rulings of the majority directly contradicted court precedents, but Roberts and his colleagues did not come out and say that the old cases had been overruled. This frustrated Scalia and Thomas, who wanted to see the court make more explicit denunciations of its past. In a concurring opinion in the campaign finance case, Scalia chided Roberts for his failure to administer the coup de grace to the earlier ruling. "This faux judicial restraint is judicial obfuscation," Scalia wrote. Scalia had a point. Roberts had engaged in the pretense of minimalism, that is, of respecting the court's precedents, without actually doing so. Leaving cases like Breyer's Stenberg opinion on the books without actually following their holdings amounted to a kind of sophistry, and Scalia, to his credit, believed in candor in opinion writing. But Roberts coolly turned such complaints aside. The labels on the opinions may have been misleading, but their contents were not. By the spring of 2007, the court was a more conservative institution, and so, it followed, were the rules of American life. The court puts off its most contentious cases for the last weeks, and the toughest of all for the last day. Three cases remained. Kennedy announced the first, when the court didn't even offer the pretense of minimalism and overruled a 96-year-old precedent. Since the case, known as Dr. Miles in 1911, the court had held that antitrust law forbade manufacturers from setting minimum prices for their products. The idea was that minimum prices discouraged competition and raised costs for consumers. Henceforth, according to Kennedy and the four conservatives, minimum prices would sometimes be allowed. As always, Kennedy gave a longer summary of his opinion than the others tended to do, and Breyer, two seats to his right, rolled his eyes in irritation. "Justice Stevens, Justice Souter, Justice Ginsburg, and I have filed a dissenting opinion," Breyer began in his sing-song voice. "I want here to emphasize one point, stare decisis. That was his theme for the day and for the year, that the conservatives were abandoning the rule of precedent without justification. In the next case, it was Kennedy again, this time siding with the four liberals. They struck down a death sentence for a Texas man who suffered from mental illness. This case reflected true judicial minimalism, because the court set down no new rules and simply ordered the lower court to give the man a new hearing. Thomas, the court's most reliable supporter of executions, wrote a dissent for Roberts, Scalia, and Alito, but he declined to speak from the bench. Then finally, it came down to the last case of the year, the combined appeals on the Louisville and Seattle school desegregation cases, and Roberts announced he would deliver the opinion himself. Few justices in history have taken to opinion writing as quickly as Roberts. The new chief is good-natured, to be sure, but he is also intensely competitive, and he writes his opinions as he did his briefs when he was a litigator, with crystalline logic, pungent rhetoric, and vivid examples. Once more, the court was limiting a precedent rather than overturning it outright. Now it was O'Connor's Grutter opinion, but the message was the same as in the other cases. The conservative majority had arrived. Like any warrior, Roberts took the high ground, and at the Supreme Court, there is no rampart more protected than Brown v. Board of Education, the unanimous landmark decision of 1954, where Chief Justice Earl Warren forbade official segregation in public schools. To Roberts, any plan that assigned even a single student for a single year to a school based on his race violated Brown. Before Brown, school children were told where they could and could not go to school based on the color of their skin. The school districts in these cases could not have carried the heavy burden of demonstrating that we should allow this once again, even for very different reasons. The Chief Justice read in his flat Midwestern accent, "The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race." Breyer then spoke for 27 minutes, one of the longest spoken protests in the court's history, summarizing a dissenting opinion that he called twice as long as any other I have written. Kennedy agreed with the result in the Louisville and Seattle cases, but not with all of Roberts' opinion. In a vague and confusing concurring opinion of his own, Kennedy suggested that some race-conscious plans might be permissible, but not those in these two cities. Many big city schools were, in fact, already moving away from the explicit race consciousness of Louisville and Seattle, concentrating more on raising test scores than mixing races. Thus, the practical effect of the day's decisions was left rather mysterious and may turn out to be modest. But Breyer wrote at such length and spoke with such passion because of something more than just the immediate stakes. In part, he, joined again by all three other liberals, was simply offended at the hijacking of Brown by the conservatives. The lesson of history is not that efforts to continue racial segregation are constitutionally indistinguishable from efforts to achieve racial integration, he said, and it is a cruel distortion of history to compare Topeka, Kansas in the 1950s to Louisville and Seattle in the modern day. In part two, Breyer saw planted in Roberts' opinion the end of all affirmative action in employment, in business, and in government as well as in education. The colorblind Constitution, long favored by Scalia and Thomas, and now apparently by Roberts and Alito, would end it all. But Breyer, most fundamentally, was talking about the court. For the second time that day, he asked, what has happened to stare decisis? He listed Grutter and six more cases that now appeared to be dead letters. The plurality's logic writes these cases out of the law, he said, and then added words that did not appear in the published version of his dissenting opinion. It is not often in law that so few have so quickly changed so much. At this direct slap, Alito roused himself and stared across the bench at Breyer. Roberts didn't change expression, but the muscles in his jaw twitched. Above all, Breyer was taking a stand against the agenda that was born in the Reagan years, nurtured by the Federalist Society, championed by the right wing of the Republican Party, and propelled by the nominations of Roberts and Alito. Expand executive power. End racial preferences intended to assist African Americans. Speed executions. Welcome religion into the public sphere. and above all, reverse Roe v.ersus Wade and allow states to ban abortion. As Breyer knew better than anyone, the two new justices, plus Scalia, Thomas, and usually Kennedy, put all those goals tantalizingly within reach. As soon as Breyer finished, Roberts, graceful as always, closed the year by paying tribute to Henry Fenwick, the court's food preparation specialist, who would be retiring 2 days later after 38 years of service. "Thanks for everything, Harry," Roberts said, and then the Chief Justice declared a recess until the first Monday in October. On the day that President Bush nominated John Roberts to the Supreme Court, the future Chief Justice reflected upon the great symbol at the heart of Cass Gilbert's design, the steps. "I always got a lump in my throat whenever I walked up those marble steps to argue a case before the court," Roberts said, "and I don't think it was just from the nerves." Over the years, countless Americans have shared Roberts' sense of awe as they entered Gilbert's Temple of Justice. Soon, however, no one else will. The steps will be closed to the public as an entranceway to the court. Rehnquist made the renovation of the Supreme Court building a priority during his final years as Chief Justice. Like many government building projects, a fairly modest restoration metastasized into an over-budget, much-delayed shambles, which may or may not be completed around 2009. And like much else in Washington after September 11, 2001, the design decisions about the renovation were made with obsessive attention to the issue of security. Most notably, the public entrance up the front steps, the defining feature of Gilbert's concept for the structure, was deemed an undue risk. So a new entrance will be gouged into the side of the steps near the base of the building. Visitors will still be allowed to depart down the front steps and watch Gilbert's vision recede behind them. Whether the closing of the steps turns out to be a metaphor for deeper change at the court will be determined in part by the justices, but even more by the American people. More than any other influence, the court has always reflected the political currents driving the broader society. In the early days of the Republic, when regional conflict predominated, the tension could be seen on the court. Presidents felt obligated to replace, say, a California justice with another from the same state. Later, of course, it passed almost without notice that the court for many years had two justices, Rehnquist and O'Connor, from the relatively unpopulated state of Arizona. In the 19th and 20th centuries, the great tide of European immigration put religion near the center of politics, and the tradition of a Catholic seat and a Jewish seat arose. The fact that President Clinton drew little comment by appointing two Jews to the court proved the passing of this era. Likewise, there was little significance that there are now five Catholic justices. The most important liberal in the court's history, William Brennan, was Catholic too. Today, the fundamental divisions in American society are not regional or religious, but ideological. Roberts, Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito were not appointed because they are Catholic, but because they are conservative. The base of the Republican Party, from James Dobson and Jay Sekulow among the evangelicals to Ted Olson and Leonard Leo among the Federalists, recognized that they could use their influence to shape the court. They organized more, mobilized more, cared more about the court than their liberal counterparts. And when their candidate won the presidency, these conservatives demanded more. A pair of justices who were precisely to their liking, and the ejection of one nominee, Harriet Myers, who was not. With admirable candor and even greater passion, conservatives have invested in the court to advance their goals for the country. In public, at least, Roberts himself purports to have a different view of the court than his conservative sponsors. "Judges are like umpires," he said at his confirmation hearing. "Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them." Elsewhere, Roberts has often said, "Judges are not politicians." None of this is true. When it comes to the core of the court's work, determining the contemporary meaning of the Constitution, it is ideology, not craft or skill, that controls the outcome of cases. As Richard A. Posner, the great conservative judge and law professor, has written, it is rarely possible to say with a straight face of a Supreme Court constitutional decision that it was decided correctly or incorrectly. Constitutional cases, Posner wrote, can be decided only on the basis of a political judgment, and a political judgment cannot be called right or wrong by reference to legal norms. For this reason, Breyer's wan longing for stare decisis will stir few hearts. Breyer and his liberal colleagues, joined on this occasion by Kennedy, did not care about stare decisis when they voted in Lawrence v. Texas to overturn the court's barely 17-year-old decision in Bowers v. Hardwick. Rather, they believed that the time had come to recognize that it was an abomination to allow criminal punishment of consensual homosexual sex, and voted accordingly. On that occasion, as so often, ideology trumped precedent. It is, of course, possible to overstate the flexibility in the meaning of the Constitution. Honorable judges always tether their views to the words of the document, its history, and the precedents, so the justice's freedom to interpret is vast but not absolute. Still, when it comes to the incendiary political issues that end up in the Supreme Court, what matters is not the quality of the arguments, but the identity of the justices. There is, for example, no meaningful difference between Scalia and Ginsburg in intelligence, competence, or ethics. What separates them is judicial philosophy, ideology, and that means everything on the Supreme Court. Future justices will all likely be qualified to meet the basic requirements of the job. It is their ideologies that will shape the court and thus the nation. So one factor, and one factor only, will determine the future of the Supreme Court: the outcomes of presidential elections. Presidents pick justices to extend their legacies. By this standard, George W. Bush chose wisely. The days when justices surprised the presidents who appointed them are over. The last two purported surprises, Souter and Kennedy, were anything but. Souter's record pegged him as a moderate. Kennedy was nominated because the more conservative Robert Bork was rejected by the Senate. All of the subsequently appointed justices, Thomas, Ginsburg, Breyer, Roberts, and Alito, have turned out precisely as might have been expected by the presidents who appointed them. That will almost certainly be true, too, of the replacements for the three justices most likely to depart in the near future, Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg. This is as it should be. Cass Gilbert's steps represent at some level a magnificent illusion that the Supreme Court operates at a higher plane than the mortals who toil on the ground. But the court is a product of a democracy and represents, with sometimes chilling precision, the best and worst of the people. We can expect nothing more and nothing less than the court we deserve. This is Jeffrey Toobin. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. This program was produced by Jacob Bronstein, directed and abridged by John McElroy. Post-production by John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2007 by Jeffrey Toobin. Production copyright 2007, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.